Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group, was recorded on April 11th, 2012, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group's teleforum conference call on grand jury reform. My name is Paul Zimmerman, and I'm Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. Before we begin, please note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Also, this call is being recorded for possible future use as a podcast or other online use. Today, we're discussing reforming the grand jury system in the United States. On this teleforum call, the speakers will discuss the goals of the grand jury system, whether or not those goals are being met, and various proposed reforms on both the state and federal level, including a recent report from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers calling for reforms such as defense representation in the grand jury room and production of witness transcripts for the defense. A link to this report is available on the email you received announcing this call. We're joined today by Mr. Gerald Lefcourt, Mr. McGregor W. Scott, and Mr. Thomas P. Sullivan. We'll start with Mr. Lefcourt, after whom we'll move on to Mr. Scott, then Mr. Sullivan. Then we'll take questions from our call-in audience. Gerald Lefcourt of Gerald B. Lefcourt, PC, is currently president of the Criminal Justice Foundation of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the founder of the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Mr. Lefcourt, thank you very much for joining us, and you can please begin your remarks.
Thank you for having me. There was a Judiciary Committee chair from Illinois, where Mr. Sullivan is from, who noted recently that the federal grand jury, originally established by the Founding Fathers as a means of protecting American citizens against government excess, is now a captive of federal prosecutors. The prosecutor exercises enormous power, unrestrained by law or judicial supervision. The grand jury process itself is largely devoid of any rules. The process has become one that wholly fails to protect ordinary American citizens. The balance has shifted so dramatically in favor of the prosecution that it has been noted, as House Judiciary Committee Chairman said, that a good prosecutor could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And indeed, as a practitioner for the last 35 years in the federal criminal justice system, I have seen that come to light. As a young lawyer, I once appeared before a federal judge in New York City asking permission for my client to testify in a grand jury that was investigating his conduct. The prosecutor opposed, and the judge said, "I am without power to tell the prosecutor to allow your client to testify." Such is the state of the grand jury. There is really no rights to the citizen, even though it was established to protect the ordinary citizen. For instance, not only is there no right to testify in the grand jury, there's no right to have counsel if you are before the grand jury and the prosecutor wants you there. There's no right to have exculpatory evidence presented in a federal grand jury. Transcripts are rarely made available for witnesses who are not called to trial. There is a requirement that the grand jury find probable cause to believe somebody committed a crime before returning an indictment, but there's no mechanism to have that reviewed. Federal judges will not look behind a grand jury indictment to find out whether indeed there was sufficient evidence or even legal evidence. And there's been no way to challenge what has occurred before the federal grand jury, because the Supreme Court, in a series of many decisions over the last 25 years, have made it impossible to look behind the grand jury indictment, because if there is a fair trial, it is merged with whatever the grand jury did. And even if there was no evidence before the grand jury, one can't look back. So some of the minimal reforms considered and proposed in the study that was done at the request of the Foundation for Criminal Justice asked for very minimal rights, such as counsel in the grand jury if someone is testifying in the grand jury. That does not mean counsel having any role in the grand jury other than to advise the client, not to speak, not to object. And many states now have this. And this particular study has looked at two states that has this. New York, for instance, and Colorado, which is also studied, have had the right to have counsel in the grand jury for many years. In New York, since 1978, without problems, and it continues to today. Another reform proposed is that if there are grand jury transcripts of witnesses, and most places the grand jury is subject to minutes taken by court reporters, that those minutes be produced. And the third reform is to make sure there is notice for someone who is going to be in the grand jury and that they would do away with something called forthwith subpoenas, which really gives somebody no time to prepare for a grand jury appearance. And the fourth is the requirement that there be a presentation of exculpatory evidence, evidence that's that exonerates the accused, if there any such evidence exists. There are significant problems with the way the federal grand jury operates today. It's not only the prosecutor's pet, because everything that's done there is done in secret, and it is the prosecutor, he or she, who's presenting evidence, decides what is to be presented, when, and what the grand jury is asked to do, and essentially, there is no review. And grand jury subpoenas can force citizens or entities to produce anything that the prosecutor wants produced. Your emails, your text messages, there's no search warrant required, there's no court approval required. It's just on the whim of a prosecutor to have the grand jury subpoena issued. And grand jurors who spend their time only with the prosecution, never see the defense, never see anybody other than the prosecutors and the agents working with them, will issue a subpoena for simply anything the prosecutor asks for. So the state of the law is, unfortunately, the grand jury has become a captive of the prosecutors. There is almost no rights to the citizen with respect to the federal grand jury. And just to end, I like what Judge Hawkins of the Ninth Circuit said when he learned about the Duke lacrosse catastrophe. He said, if you describe what happened in that case to a stranger and didn't say what country it happened in, America is not the first place that would come to mind. No exculpatory evidence, a total one-sided system creating a catastrophe. Now, most prosecutors work hard and are fair, and the problems, I believe, are at the margins. But with the massive increase in the number of prosecutors over the last 30 years on the federal level, and the more over-criminalization of federal criminal law, the number of crimes, the number of prosecutors, the number of agents has so dramatically increased that the problems at the margins have increased as well. And so these simple reforms should be seriously considered by Congress. They are only seeking minimal justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lefcourt. Our next speaker will be McGregor Scott. Mr. Scott is a partner in Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe LLP's Sacramento office, and is a member of the litigation group focusing on white-collar criminal defense and corporate investigation. Mr. Scott, please go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I come from a slightly different perspective than Mr. Lefcourt with respect to our careers, and if I could just briefly describe that. I started at a law school as a deputy district attorney in a county in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I presented many cases to the county grand jury for indictment. I then served as an elected district attorney here in California, where I oversaw the presentation of many cases to our county grand jury. And then most recently, I served as the United States attorney here in the Eastern District of California in Sacramento, where obviously it was my responsibility to lead and direct a large number of assistant U.S. attorneys, not just in the presentation of indictments, but also ultimately in the prosecution of those cases. So I think I perhaps come to this panel with a little bit of a different perspective, having actually presented cases as a prosecutor to the state grand jury at the county level, but also overseeing the federal indictment process. And one thing that really stands out to me based on that experience is the very, very different sets of rules and procedure which exist in different jurisdictions. By way of example, some of the proposals that have been put forward in the report by the National Association, such as access to grand jury transcripts and the disclosure to the grand jury of exculpatory evidence, are statutory requirements under California law. So, in other words, the deputy district attorney is required to present to the grand jury or make known to the grand jury any exculpatory evidence that may exist. In addition, the California grand jury structure requires that the evidence presented to the grand jury only be evidence which would be admissible at a trial. In other words, the rules of evidence apply before the grand jury in California. The federal system obviously is very different. There is no requirement for exculpatory evidence. Most times there is no access to grand jury transcripts, as Mr. Lefcourt described. And hearsay is broadly used for the purpose of returning grand jury indictments. So I think that's a point that we might want to reflect on a little bit here today, is the vast diversity of the rules of procedure which surround grand juries in this country. The second point I would make is that while I think we're going to agree, I suspect we're going to agree today on this panel that some of these proposed reforms are appropriate and warranted, it would be my position that the greatest check on the abuse of governmental power in the form of use of the grand jury is an ethical, well-trained prosecutor who understands their ethical responsibilities as prosecutors and fully grasps the great power that they possess in presenting cases to the grand jury for indictment. Because, you know, the famous line 25, almost 30 years ago now from Raymond Donovan, President Reagan's labor secretary, who had been indicted by a federal grand jury but was acquitted at trial. And Mr. Donovan walked out and famously said, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?" And I think prosecutors in good offices where there is good leadership have that sense of responsibility to do the right thing for the right reasons every day drummed into them. There will always be excesses, and Mr. Lefcourt, I think, very appropriately points out the Duke lacrosse situation where you had a county-elected district attorney who was more concerned about getting reelected than doing the right thing for the right reasons. I would put forward that the concept of access to grand jury transcripts, advance notice to those who are going to be called to testify before the grand jury, and the disclosure to the grand jury of exculpatory evidence are all reasonable, forthright reforms of the present system. With respect to counsel in the grand jury room, under California law, there is a right to counsel before civil proceedings before the grand jury, because in California, the county grand jury has a civil investigatory, sort of the watchdog of local government role to perform, and witnesses can be called in that capacity, and there is a right to counsel. There is not a right to counsel with respect to criminal potential criminal indictments being sought by the DA or the Attorney General. And I have mixed feelings about that. Having been in that role, I would not be crazy about having a defense attorney sitting there, no matter how constrained by the rules and the procedures. If I was seeking an indictment in a politically charged case, in one which had great notoriety or public attention brought to it, and it would be my perspective that, again, ethical, properly trained prosecutors, starting with the elected DA or the U.S. attorney, have to make sure that their offices are properly using the great power which is provided to them through the grand jury. One final note I would make, I've commented quite a bit about the California system, and I think it's appropriate to point out that because, candidly, obtaining a holding order from a judge at a preliminary hearing is much easier than presenting a case to the grand jury. The common practice in California is to go by route of preliminary hearing following an information rather than the grand jury, because hearsay is admissible through a properly trained police officer, and the process is much simpler and much more straightforward. So it sort of cuts both ways. We have, I think, very stringent rules with respect to the grand jury in California, but the fallback position is that the grand jury is very, very seldom used to bring indictments in California. So I think we have to balance what the end result would be out of reforms. It may make it more appropriate for a federal prosecutor, easier for a federal prosecutor to go to a judge and do a preliminary hearing rather than an indictment. So thank you for your time.
We'll move on to Tom Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan is a partner at Jenner & Block, LLP, who has practiced law for over 50 years. He represents several major companies in civil suits and serves as an arbitrator in other matters, and he served as U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois from 1977 to 1981. So, Mr. Sullivan, please go ahead with your remarks.
All right, thank you. Yes, I just to summarize a little bit more about my background so the listeners can understand my perspective. I have practiced law for over 55 years. Most of my work has been in trial work in both civil and criminal cases. And of that time, only 4 years was spent as a prosecutor. When I became U.S. attorney during the Carter administration, I had had no previous prosecutorial experience, nor have I served as a public defender. I've done a great deal of pro bono defense work in criminal cases. And when I was U.S. attorney, I tried 6 cases personally, but I do not have a strong or long prosecutorial background. Back in 1984, before I became U.S. attorney, I wrote an article directed towards this very issue, which I called "If It Ain't Broke, Don't Fix It," and it sort of summarized my views then and my views now that the grand jury need not be abolished, although it is not, as McGregor pointed out, it is not commonly used in certain states, but certain reforms would be advisable along the lines that Jerry Lefcourt mentioned. I think there are some benefits that can be achieved through a grand jury. It's a formal proceeding. It is in the Illinois and in the federal system. There are court reporters that take down everything that's said. It provides the prosecutor a means of subpoenaing documents and witnesses and looking at them in private with the grand jury present, although most of the subpoenas that I've seen, even though they are entitled grand jury, call for return before an agent rather than the grand jury. It really doesn't work the way it says. But it does give citizens the right to be present and to observe what's going on, and to the extent to which there might be improper conduct by agents or prosecutors towards witnesses, it is inhibited by the presence of citizens. And it also allows the citizens to ask questions if they want to. In Illinois, our statute provides that a person who is under investigation by a grand jury has the right to be accompanied by counsel in front of the grand jury who can advise him of his rights during the proceeding, but may not participate in any other way. And I have not heard any complaints by the Illinois prosecutors about that provision, that is, that the lawyers have not been disruptive or created a problem. It is also important to note, however, that to my knowledge, in most cases, the target of the grand jury investigation is not called before the grand jury, so that this provision is probably not used very often in practice. Normally, and from what I saw as when I was a prosecutor and in charge of the office, hearsay is allowed in the grand jury. Very often, the presentation is not made by witnesses, but rather by an agent who goes before the grand jury and summarizes what people have said. And it can be as one-sided as the man or woman wants to make it, and the prosecutor wants to make it. The use of the grand jury gives the prosecutor tremendous power, and if you have a prosecutor who is bent on getting an indictment, as Jerry pointed out, the grand juries usually, almost universally, will indict when the prosecutor wants the indictment. It's rare, to my knowledge, to have a no bill returned by a grand jury after the prosecutor has asked for an indictment, and they usually follow the prosecutor's recommendations. Most of the witnesses, or many of the witnesses, I guess I should say, that have been called before a grand jury have been prepared before they go before the grand jury, unless they're adverse to the government or the state. In other words, if they are the witnesses or the victims of crime, they are talked to and prepared by agents or assistant prosecutors before they appear before the grand jury, so the testimony they give is often very well prepared and somewhat rote. I do believe, and I have seen instances of this, where in the state system, and I'm particularly talking about Illinois, where we have elected prosecutors who are elected every 4 years, there is a serious risk of the use of the ability to prosecute for political purposes. I don't know that there is any solution to that other than what McGregor talked about, which is to have people who have integrity and professional responsibility in the role, but you can't guarantee that when you have either, as you do in the federal system, an appointed largely by the senior senator of the party that's in the White House, or in the state system where they elect them, and so any lawyer in the county can run, and a lot of them do it on, and you end up with this claim of we're going to get tough on crime, and it can have some very adverse consequences to people that get in the gun sight of the prosecutor who is more politically inclined than legally inclined. Some of the reforms that the National Association has recommended, such as having a review procedure before a presentation to the grand jury, a clear charge to the grand jury, which is normally done by the chief judge of the county or the district in the federal system, and the requirement to produce exculpatory evidence, are good. The question, of course, particularly with regard to exculpatory evidence, is how do you enforce it? Many defense lawyers, in my experience, if asked to bring the exculpatory evidence before the grand jury, won't do it because they don't want to disclose their defense. So it is a tactical matters get involved here. But I do think the grand jury ought to be retained with strong recommendations for some of these reforms that are have been made public in these publications. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. I want to go back through the speakers and give each of you a chance to respond to what the others have said. Mr. Lefcourt, you can begin.
Well, one point that, you know, it's not necessarily a response, but, you know, today, one bad newspaper article about somebody stays with them for the rest of their lives. We have a system now of the Internet and Google, which, you know, everything that's, you know, that's there stays there for all time. And we say this to kids all the time, not to be putting things on Facebook or texting or whatever, because these things will never go away. Well, just think about that in terms of an indictment that is improperly obtained. And I liked what you reminded us, McGregor, about the prosecution of the Secretary of Labor, who said, "Where do I see about my reputation?" What a lot of these reforms are suggesting is that the grand jury should be allowed to hear the other side. Right now, the federal grand jury doesn't have to, if the prosecutor doesn't want it to, ever hear anything from the defense. They can't hear from the prospective defendant. The defense counsel could submit anything he wants to the prosecutor and ask that he or she present it to the grand jury, but there's no obligation. And there's no review. No court has the power to go behind the indictment. So this is a system that not only doesn't protect citizens, it is so lopsided that it's totally unfair. I'm not saying it should be abandoned. I'm saying it should be reformed. And so if that's a response to what anybody said, so be it. But the problem is when I was that young lawyer and went before the federal judge and said my client wants to testify and the prosecutor said no, that indictment was his reputation and it will be there forever. And now with everything online in terms of the court system, we have, you know, everything that's filed now is part of a permanent record that never goes away. And so even if the indictment is dismissed, or acquitted, it's always there.
Okay, great. Mr. Scott, I'll give you a chance to respond. And, you know, what about that? Should we make these procedures more strict so that we can save people's reputations and not subject them to this process needlessly?
Well, I think it is vital, as we've addressed here so far, I'll say this morning because it's still morning in the West, but I think several of the ideas that have been advanced, I would be in agreement with, to try to bring back some semblance of balance between the two things, the right of the government to bring its prosecutions and the right of individuals to be safe from excessive or inappropriate governmental action. I think it is important to remember that in the federal system, There is, Mr. Lefcourt is absolutely correct in terms of his analysis about no court review. I would point out that, by way of example, in my old office here, the Eastern District of California, there was a very regimented process of review within the office before an assistant United States attorney could seek an indictment. And you'd have a case worked up for some time with, let's just say, an FBI agent, maybe it's an IRS, DEA, whatever it may be. And then the AUSA would have to go to his or her team chief to get approval, and that team chief would do a thorough vetting of the case. Then the potential indictment would go to the criminal chief for the entire office for his review approval, and then and only then would it come to me as the U.S. attorney for my approval and actually sign the formal indictment before it was presented. So I'm not saying this is a perfect system, but I think it's important to point out that we don't have rogue AUSAs out there just running around bringing indictments whenever they want to, that there is very much a process in place. And ultimately, obviously, the department at the headquarters level in Washington tries to bring some semblance of consistency and approach to how cases are brought, what cases are brought, and how they're brought across the country in the 94 different districts. So I'm not saying that this is the cure-all. I'm not saying it's the solution, but I do think it's important to point out that there are some internal checks within the department. And having come from the state system to the federal system, I would say, in my estimation, that there is a – obviously there are going to be exceptions to every rule, but I think the very broad rule is that AUSAs, certainly the seasoned veterans who've been there and have the supervisorial roles within the criminal division, have a great sense and appreciation for the power that the federal government has. Do they get it right every time? No, they obviously don't. But there is a profound respect for and appreciation of the great power that they have, and I think a very concerted effort day in and day out to try to do the right thing for the right reasons.
Can I just say one thing before you go to Mr. Sullivan?
Sure.
You know, as you were talking, McGregor, I was just thinking about the review process you described. And what would Senator Ted Stevens say to that? I mean, here is a sitting United States senator who, with all the reviews you could talk about in a highly politicized case, gets indicted, and the prosecutors and all the reviews in the world, and it's out of Washington, fail to disclose crucial exculpatory evidence leading to a conviction of the senator that was thrown out by the attorney general when everything came to light. So I know there's a review process, and I know that prosecutors generally try to do the right thing. And there's also this other element. We're in a very competitive society. Prosecutors want to come out of those offices and get jobs in firms like both of yours, and they want to win. And when they want to win too much, they cut corners. And we have no rules in place with respect to the grand jury that in any way curtails their power. And I'm sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Mr. Scott, do you have any response to that?
Well, all I would say with respect to Senator Stevens, obviously this is a profound embarrassment for the department. It's a profound, it's just a tragedy on multiple levels. I don't profess to be an expert on what went wrong in that trial, but it's my understanding that the decisions made and the failure to act undertaken by the department lawyers all occurred post-indictment, that they became aware of exculpatory evidence in or about the time that trial was commencing or about to commence. So I appreciate the point that's being made, but I don't know that it's directly relevant to the grand jury subject and review process that we're discussing today.
Yeah, I'd like to move on to Mr. Sullivan. Do you have any comments on those comments or any responses?
Well, I am in agreement that in the federal system, it's been my observation that there is a high level of professionalism, regardless of which party is in the White House. For one thing, the assistants, at least in the Northern District of Illinois, and I think mostly throughout the country, they don't change when the U.S. attorney changes. The U.S. attorney doesn't get rid of everybody that's there and start over. So you do have these people who've been there many times. The United States attorney is a former assistant. And so you have experienced people. And as Jerry said, they want to win cases. But when you want to win cases, that's in itself a restraint on bringing unwarranted indictments. And if there's exculpatory evidence, it ought to be known, sometimes can't be, but it ought to be known before the indictment is returned and considered. And I when I was U.S. Attorney, I had a similar system of review that McGregor described. I personally believe that the greatest danger here comes in elected state's attorneys in the states, where you can get rogue lawyers who run and get elected as state's attorney and then take out after, in highly publicized cases. This is street crime, for example. We've had so many exculpations in Illinois of people that have been indicted and convicted and spent a great number of years in jail. I personally tried a case 2 years ago of a man who had spent, he was in jail since 1992, just got out for a murder he didn't commit, and the court of appeal, the appellate court finally said that no reasonable person could find him guilty under this evidence. That to me is the serious problem here, and I'm not sure that any of what you write down as a reform is going to change it, because life ain't like that. We are all ambitious, and there are some who are willing to go over the line in order to achieve their ends.
We have a couple of questions here, so we'll go to the first caller.
This is John Rowland, Constitution.org. The proposals by the National Association are good as far as they go, but let me suggest that they are a little too timid. That what needs to be done is to return to the original meaning of grand jury as of 1791 and to see what we need to do to get back to the standard of grand jury practice at that time, which would include such things as the grand jury being open to complaints by any citizen, having the duty to investigate the jurisdiction of a case and which court may or may not hear it, and to issue indictments not just to professional prosecutors, but to anyone presenting the complaint. So, which could, of course, be a complaint against the prosecutor for the way he may be handling the grand jury. So, what do you think about these more fundamental reforms?
Does anyone like to take that?
We are so far away from that. it's almost laughable. It's hard to even think about that. I mean, the federal grand jury it has been a tool of the prosecution for at least 25 or 30 years, and it is changing and has changed rapidly over that time to give more and more power. I mean, just some of the things we've heard, the notion that you could have pure hearsay, not present exculpatory evidence, subpoena anything from anybody without any court supervision, and exclude the subject, the person who is a putative target, from playing any role is astounding. And it is why, there's this outcry for change. And I agree with you that these reforms are minimal. And, so minimal, I don't know why hearsay is permitted. In the state of New York and in other states, competent evidence must be presented to the grand jury. And a judge reviews the minutes of the grand jury to see whether that occurred. And if it didn't occur, the judge dismisses the charges. There is no procedure in the federal system to have anything that occurred before the grand jury reviewed. So I would agree with you that these reforms are minimal.
Any response from any of the other speakers?
Well, this is Tom Sullivan. I don't think that we're going to go back to where citizens get the right to seek indictments through the grand juries or indict the prosecutor. I think we're a long way away from that. It may be the greatest reform you can think of, but I think it's illusory at this point.
Okay, any quick follow-up from the questioner?
Yes, I have received a copy of a pleading filed in a recent case by the Department of Justice in which they take the position that a citizen does not have the authority or the right to testify before a grand jury, and that the grand jury has no authority to issue presentments. And of course, that is a total departure from the original concept of grand jury, which is a body that can investigate anything on their own initiative and make a report, a presentment, on any subject whatsoever. And I think that the pleading presented provides a documentary evidence of the extent of apostasy to the Constitution that we now suffer from. And I suggest that we should not just be making timid reform proposals, but we should go for the whole thing and total compliance with the Constitution as originally understood and stick to it. I might not get it all, but we can try.
Okay, any response?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that there are a lot more reforms, including some that have just been mentioned, that are appropriate, but, you know, having been in the, you know, in the whole notion of trying to reform the grand jury now for, I guess it's 15 years, one of my close friends is a former deputy at the Department of Justice, Larry Thompson, who has been advocating the same kinds of reforms and many more than are on the table in this conversation for at least 15 years. And he was part of this project that was undertaken and is a big advocate. And he's certainly been a United States attorney. He's been number two in the Department of Justice. He's seen it all. But this is an uphill battle to get Congress to focus. I mean, quite frankly, a lot of our congressmen and senators are oblivious to this whole notion. Many of them are, you know, not lawyers, don't know anything about the workings of how the federal criminal justice system operates. And so it's a tough grind to get anything done.
Okay. We'll go ahead and move on to the next question.
Hello, this is Bob Davis from Maine. I'm not an attorney, so please indulge my ignorance. I have two questions. Why has indictment by a grand jury not been incorporated? And if it is, and federal reforms are made, would they be applicable to the states as well?
Okay. Any takers on that question?
This is Tom Sullivan. If the federal system was reformed, it would not affect the states. I didn't catch your first question.
The first question is, why has indictment by a grand jury not been incorporated?
Incorporated into what?
Through the 14th Amendment, the incorporation doctrine.
Oh, I see what you mean. I'll leave that to the others.
Mr. Scott or Mr. Lefcourt want to take that?
Well, I think it's the United States Constitution. It has not been incorporated, and we've just heard at length from McGregor. California has a different system. They don't have the grand jury in the state. I don't know that it's ever been presented to the Supreme Court.
Well, I think it has, Jerry, but it's not. I can't cite the case, but I think it's not required, and it would require a new Supreme Court decision in order to do it. But in any event, the second question is, if they did reform the federal system, would it affect the states? And I think the answer is clearly no.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right.
All right, let's move on to the next question.
Yes, my name is Bill Otis. I'm an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown, although I spent most of my career as in charge of appeals for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia. I'm surprised that our guests have not mentioned either the grand jury's role in the Constitution, nor have they mentioned the leading Supreme Court case deciding the powers of the grand jury, that being an opinion by Justice Powell in 1974 called Calandra versus the United States. Calandra not only permitted hearsay evidence to come before the grand jury, but permitted unconstitutionally seized evidence to come before the grand jury. As I say, it was written by Justice Powell and joined by, among others, Justice White and Justice Blackmun. What I think some of our panelists are after is something that the Constitution does not envision. The Constitution envisioned the grand jury as an inquisitorial proceeding, not like a trial, an adversary proceeding. So the fact that the grand jury is one-sided is something that the framers knew about and intended. They wanted to allow defendants to have a full and fair trial at which they would have a chance then to make their defense such as it might be. they never intended for there to be the presentation of adversary advocates before the grand jury. And if there were, if that were to come about, or if there were to be preliminary review of a grand jury, what that would actually lead to is the lawyers marching before a judge saying that, you know, with more litigation, more challenges, more delay on top of an over-delayed and over-procedured system that we have now. Again, I hope the panelists will be able to comment on whether they believe that Calandra was wrongly decided and whether they think that what with the crime rate having been cut in half over the last 20 years with the procedures we have now, whether the grand jury and what they say is wrong with the grand jury is really something that the public would think is wrong with the grand jury, as opposed to merely the defense bar thinking is wrong with it.
Mr. Lefkowitz, would you like to respond?
Oh, boy. I have certainly a lot to say about that. Yeah, I do think Calandra was wrongly decided. The notion that somebody could be charged based on just some hearsay statement without any substantive evidence, I don't know that it says that in the Constitution. I understand it's a decision of the Supreme Court, but decisions of the Supreme Court can be overrided by rule change or statutes, and that's what we're advocating. It's silly to suggest that Calandra reduced crime. First of all, the federal system has not as much of a role in the reduction of crime than the states do in the national police forces that all the states have. And there are many reasons for reduction of crime, and we can go, that's a whole other conversation. There's a change in drug use. There's even Roe v. Wade, people think, have caused a reduction in crime. That's not the issue, and crime was not affected by Calandra. The issue is that we should have a fair system, not a lopsided system. And the grand jury was initially conceived of to protect citizens, which the questioner didn't mention. It's not simply an inquisitorial body. It's a body that would prevent unfounded charges against citizens. And today, more than ever, I mean, we are living in a modern world. An unfounded charge made public is forever damaging today, not so years before the internet. So those are few of my responses to the questioner's comments.
Mr. Scott or Mr. Sullivan, do you have anything to respond, anything to add?
Yeah, I would say that I think Mr. Otis brings out a good point, which is that the purpose of the grand jury is essentially to conduct a probable cause hearing. The actual language from the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. So it clearly applies to being held to answer for the charge, not guilt or innocence or the government's failure to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think it's a very relevant point that he makes. And I referenced earlier the concept of preliminary hearings in California. Same standard. It's a probable cause hearing to see whether or not the defendant, if there is probable cause to believe that the defendant has in fact committed the crime that the prosecutor has charged him with. So I think it's a very relevant point in terms of how far down the road do you go. And I would be of the opinion that, as I mentioned earlier, certainly with respect to access to grand jury transcripts and disclosure of exculpatory evidence, I think those are reasonable measures that don't impinge on the proper role of the grand jury to conduct that probable cause hearing, and in fact may add to the ability of the grand jury to make that determination.
Mr. Sullivan, do you have any response to how the Constitution bears on all of this?
No, I really don't. I think that the idea of having illegally seized evidence before a grand jury is questionable both from the defense and the prosecutor's side, because it's not going to be usable in court. and may influence the prosecutor in deciding to get an indictment. But no, I really have no other comment other than that.
Okay. Mr. Otis, do you have any follow-up to that?
Yes, one point, which is that I did not say that Calandra had reduced crime. I said that over the last 20 years, while we have had, both in the states and in federal practice, the same grand jury systems we have now, crime has been reduced by one half. The crime rate has come down by one half for all serious crimes. This would seem to me to be pretty good evidence that the grand jury system and other aspects of the criminal justice system are not broken, although they are often said to be broken by the defense bar. And lastly, I would just say that the grand jury, Mr. Lefkowitz says that the grand jury was designed by the framers to produce fairness. What was actually designed by the framers to be is exactly what it is in the federal system, which is to say a one-sided system. The framers knew that grand juries in England were one-sided, and they intended to bring that system over to the United States. And to the extent the federal government continues to have that system, they have the system that the framers wanted us to have.
Yeah, I want to give Mr. Lefkowitz a quick chance to respond, and then
ask
your other question.
I agree with everything you just said, except for one thing. The purpose of the grand jury was to protect citizens as well as to look at whether there's a crime committed. And the whole notion that one could be charged without a presentment was what people railed against at the time. And, you know, you fail to recognize that purpose of the Founding Fathers was to use the grand jury as a part of it to protect citizens from unfounded charges from the Queen or the King, which had been the practice before. So other than that, I have nothing to add.
Okay, this is Tom Sullivan. Can I interject the point about Mr. Otis's thing? It seems to me that in considering reforms to the grand jury, reforms that are going to permit the defense to interrupt the flow of proceedings and cause litigation over whether or not things have been presented or not is not in the public good, and I don't think the experience that we've had would call for that. So I think we have to be careful about making so-called reforms that are really going to end up being impediments to the proper functioning of our criminal justice system.
All right, I want to move on.
Just one sec. I totally agree with what Tom Sullivan just said, and the purpose of this study, which led to these reforms, which is part of the online presentation, the link, was to study whether having counsel or presenting exculpatory evidence, where it is done in many places already, is disruptive. That was the purpose of this study. And after the considerations of judges and prosecutors and the studies in Colorado and in New York, they found it's not disruptive. And I think Mr. Sullivan said before that in Illinois you've had the right to do that. In New York, Colorado, Massachusetts, many other states have been doing it for more than 30 years, and it's not disruptive. And what we're only saying in this proposal is now proven that it is not disruptive to have the federal grand jury be able to have people testify with counsel in a non-disruptive way.
Okay, we have two more callers, and I want to get to both of them, so I'd ask the callers to keep their questions short. So let's move on to the next caller.
John Rowland again. To answer the question about the Supreme Court case concerning grand juries in the states, the key case was Hurtado v. California, 110 U.S. 516 in 1884. And I invite people interested in investigating the matter to find that case on our website, constitution.org, and to focus particularly on the dissenting opinion of Justice Harlan, where he lays out the argument based upon the legislative history of the 14th Amendment, that amendment was intended to incorporate all of the rights recognized in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And that decision was the first major decision in which the Supreme Court refused to incorporate one of the Bill of Rights under the 14th Amendment. So it's worthwhile examining how the departure from, I think, original intent and meaning occurred, and that's a key case.
Any response to that from the speakers?
Well, I thank them for the information and the citation.
Okay. Let's move on to the final question here.
Hi, Jim Markowski, New York. This has to do with internal monitoring of overzealous assistant U.S. attorneys in the federal system. I had a witness who is not a target appearing before a grand jury investigation, which started out as a criminal antitrust investigation. There was no case there, so the assistant U.S. attorney made it a tax fraud investigation, met with my client in advance of the testimony, told my client what he wanted my client to testify to. He was an accountant. And when I pointed out to the assistant U.S. attorney, tried to, that his facts didn't match with the facts that my client knew, he threatened me with an obstruction of justice charge. What systems are in place, and that's not the worst example I could cite, but what systems are in place in the Justice Department to keep these guys under control and make sure they just don't get carried away?
Mr. Scott, do you have any response to that? Or Mr.
Yes, there's an entity within the department called the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose mission it is to receive and investigate allegations of prosecutorial misconduct or inappropriate actions in their professional capacity by assistant U.S. attorneys or U.S. attorneys. That office is located in Washington at the what we refer to as Main Justice, the headquarters building, and I'm sure that the contact information is readily available on the department's website.
Can I just say, I know that the Office of Professional Responsibility has been there probably 25 years, but it is the most criticized part of the Justice Department because it never seems to find anybody having committed prosecutorial misconduct, and whatever it does is in secret. I've been in cases where judges have referred prosecutors to the office and have never gotten a result, and it's been the subject of a controversy almost from the beginning. Some people call it the, the hotel where you go in and you never come out. It was from a song. It's not a well thought of office.
Okay, I want to give everyone one last chance to make some final comments. So we'll start with Mr. Lefcourt and then move on from there.
Well, the whole subject of grand jury reform has been kicking around for 25 or 30 years. The American Bar Association has advocated the right to have a lawyer not participate in the grand jury but be present when somebody's testified way back 30 years ago. It is one of a basic reform that seems to me to be fair and reasonable in light of the world we live in, the right to have exculpatory information presented, particularly that which the prosecutor knows of. Put aside that which was be brought to their attention by the lawyers for the target. It just seems to me basic, and hopefully, we're now at a time, having witnessed so many misguided prosecutions, such as the Stevens case, that maybe reform is in the air, hopefully.
Mr. Scott, any concluding remarks?
I think that as I've said a couple times now, I think some of the proposals put forward in this draft report make a lot of sense to me, and I think would help the grand jury in performing its proper role, which is the determination of whether or not probable cause exists to believe a person has committed a crime. And again, to reiterate one of my core points, which is that the greatest check on these governmental abuses are ethical, trained prosecutors who understand the concept of doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Hey, Mr. Sullivan.
Well, I think the ultimate solution is the personnel that are in charge of the prosecutorial office and presenting cases to the grand jury. And if you get people that are not going to follow the rules and be unfair for political or other advantage, you can write all the rules you want. It won't make any difference. I also agree with what Jerry said about the Office of Professional Responsibility and its counterpart in Illinois, where we've had prosecutors named in reviewing court opinions for making improper closing arguments and doing other improper things. And to my knowledge, not a single one of them has ever either been disciplined by our disciplinary commission or disciplined by their own offices. A lot of times they get promoted. So I think it's a person, I think we have to focus on who we're putting in charge of these offices. And I do agree with the four recommendations that the NACDL proposes to the grand jury.
Okay. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thanks so much to our call-in audience for your attention and for your questions. And I also want to thank Mr. Lefcourt, Mr. Scott, and Mr. Sullivan for taking the time to join us today and give us their perspectives on this issue. Callers, if you have any feedback, please let us know at nfip@fedsoc.org. And we are adjourned. Thanks so much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.